Just as a quick recap from last week. So last week we talked about a couple key things that will help us understand where we're going today. The first is this idea that singleness is not is a gift, it's not a superpower. So sometimes we hear the idea of the gift of singleness, and we think that therefore it's something that you can or may not have. Do I have the gift of singleness? Do they have the gift of singleness? And then when we understand it to be like a superpower, something that gives you these, you know, superhuman abilities to withstand some sort of trial or to conquer some sort of problem, it sends all sorts of mixed signals, and it's misleading in so many ways that are against what the Bible teaches about the beauty of singleness and the gift of singles to the body, to the church. A couple things. One, it denies just the goodness of singleness, that you have to have this overwhelming superhuman ability to handle it. It implies that if you don't have it, well, then maybe you can be disobedient and jump into any kind of relationship to escape it, to get out of it, that may not be biblical, right? to marry someone who's not a believer, or to get into any other kind of illicit relationship. Those are things, because we may think, I don't have this gift, and so I don't have to follow other commands of Scripture. They would be crazy to flip that and be like, well, I don't have the gift of marriage. Like, I'm in a really hard marriage, but I don't have the gift of marriage, and so I'm just gonna get out of this. And so we're misleading whenever we take this idea that it's a superpower. Now, when we talk about gifts, anytime Paul uses the idea of gifts, he gives it as an idea, he uses an idea of something that's been bestowed upon you that you should treasure and love and thank God for, and understand that it comes from the Father who gives all good things from above, and it's not given to you for selfish reasons. It's given to you to build up and uplift the body. And so that's why we want to talk about in this class that it's the gift of singles to the body, and what a joy that is, and what a gift it is from the Lord. And so we want to use that status to build up others. And part of that comes also out of 1 Corinthians 7, 25 and 35. We spent a lot of time in 1 Corinthians 7 last week. We'll come back to that passage and pull out of that deep well again this week and next week. But Paul, surprising to some, says that he has no command in regards to marital status. So you are not commanded to be married, and you are not commanded to be single. There's no command there. And again, in our culture, whether in our secular culture, or even sometimes within the church culture, we expect there to be one or the other, and which is pretty unusual, because in 1 Corinthians, Paul has tons of commands for the Corinthian church. And in this, he reiterates more than once, I have no command for you on this. I have a preference. I have something that I think is wise for you in this situation, and that applies to us now. But there's no command for marital status. And so walking in that, we're then to as Bear showed us last week out of 1 Peter, we're to love and cherish and be hospitable towards one another in their giftedness. And so as we love the gift that has been bestowed to the church in the status that's been given to each of us, we recognize that marriage does not, the existence of marriage and growing marriages and Bear's investment in the health of my marriage does not belittle his status as single. And us elevating Bear's status as single and me being engaged in it and encouraging him and being part of making sure that's a healthy status for him does not then belittle marriage. Both of those exist well in Scripture, particularly in Paul's writings. So today, what I want us to talk about is understanding those realities from Scripture. We're going to start talking about what does this practically look like when it works itself out in our life. And I want us to run up against one of the chief concerns or undercurrents that erodes this idea that singleness is a beautiful gift from God. And it's the idea that singleness equals loneliness, or that singleness equals a lack of intimacy. And Ed Shaw uses this term, the plausibility problem. So he says what our culture does is it establishes for us that that we need to be in relationship. We have to be in relationship to be whole, to achieve, to move on, to mature, to whatever else. And our church culture often reinforces that, maybe from different perspectives for different reasons, but it often does the same. In particular, from Scripture, we understand, and I use this quote from Sam Albury here, it's in your notes. From the point of view of Christianity, to be single means being both unmarried and committed for as long as we remain unmarried to sexual abstinence. So here's where the plausibility problem comes in. Our culture, more and more, is okay with the first part of that, the idea of being unmarried. It's elevated in many senses. The marrying age in the United States is higher than it's ever been. The percentage of adults who are unmarried, the normalcy of that in our culture has risen. In some cases, that's wonderful, but it's not with the second half of our understanding of biblical singleness, which is that we are committed, as long as we remain unmarried, to sexual abstinence. Our culture is not okay with the second one. Now, for many people, there's not a deep, abiding drive towards sexual union or towards sexual fulfillment. And so this isn't really an undercurrent for them. And if that's you, or if you have friends or family that fit into that category, maybe they're more asexual or demisexual, and it's just not a drive for them, great. I don't want to create a new world for you that causes a new problem that you should have this, you know, desire. That may be how the Lord has built you. But for many people, there is that desire, and our culture reinforces that should be an expectation, that our sexual identity is our chief identity. And so it is okay with us being unmarried. It is not okay with us being sexually abstinent. But the Bible sets this as a clear expectation. So last week, Bear touched on Matthew 19. And so if you'll turn with me there, we'll look at this again. Oftentimes there is a misnomer that Jesus is pretty vague or pretty loose or pretty liberal with his sexual ethics because he doesn't talk about it much. And that's bad hermeneutics. It's bad Bible study to hold that position, because he consistently affirms the Old Testament expectations of when it comes to sexual immorality, when it comes to adultery. He even raises the bar when it comes to lust, when it comes to divorce, when it comes to... And so just because he doesn't spend a ton of time breaking down the nuances of particular questions we might have about sexual ethics does not mean that we can then make an argument from his silence. And this is Matthew 19, verses 10 through 12 is a particular place where he actually makes what is easy to like dismiss as kind of confusing and maybe irrelevant because we're not really sure what he's talking about. It doesn't seem to have a cultural norm for us today. But this is an important section where he's going to elevate singleness for us in this passage. And so context, the Pharisees, as they usually do, have been quizzing Jesus. And so we'll start back in verse 3. And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" And he answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh? So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate.'" You see, again, he's elevating the teaching. And they said to him, "Why did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away?" And he said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery." The disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry." And just pause right there. I think, again, sometimes we read that first section, and it doesn't have the shock and awe to us. It doesn't really stand out. But when the disciples hear this, they are awed by this reality. You mean marriage is such a high standard that we shouldn't get out of it? Like that we are tied together by the bonds of the gospel, that as husband and wife come together, they become one and they're united with God. That's heavy. Maybe it's better that a man doesn't even marry. So they're recognizing that Christ has just raised the bar substantially. And Jesus responds, "Not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it." So, in contrast, Jesus doesn't say, no, okay, it's not that. I mean, it'll be okay. Marriage isn't hard. You can push through this. No, he says, yeah. Actually, there are those who can receive exactly what you just said. Now, again, we go back to our first point. This is not a superpower. This isn't if you've received it, you can run with it. No, it's like, but yeah, this is a high standard. And let me tell you what the flip side is. This is not marriage or one of several dozens of options that our culture is trying to normalize. He says there's two options. There is marriage, which is a covenant relationship for life between one man and one woman, which includes sexual union, or singleness, which has the expectation of celibacy. He uses the illustration here of a eunuch. He says there are some that are that way because of circumstances, there are some that way because of accidents, and there are some that choose this life for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. This is what we have chosen. This is the high bar, the high standard that Scripture has given us. But if you'll turn to the inside of your handout, what our culture has done is it has equated intimacy with sex. And so it's really important that we understand that the biblical standard is that sex does not equal intimacy. All right, and this works on so many levels. Okay, so that does mean that lots of sex does not get you lots of intimacy. Those two things are not automatically together. It does not mean that if you have little to no sex, that therefore you have little to no intimacy. Those do not correlate. Okay, just because you have lots of intimacy does not mean that you need to be having lots of sex. Those things are not directly tied together. Sex does not lead to intimacy. So what our culture wants to tell us and wants to fast track us to is to a point that, well, we don't need all these other pieces that are involved in a relationship. If we can just get to sex, we can scratch that itch that tells us that we have intimacy, we've achieved it, and then we're good to go from there. We can fill that need. We see this over and over again in all sorts of, whether it's on television or books, movies, whatever it is, where no longer does the teenage to adult rated film end with them heading off into the sunset, married and happily ever after, like the Robin Hood Disney movie, you know, where they finally at the end they head off in this little carriage. But we've achieved this significant moment. We know they're going to make it when they have sex. So you watch a rom-com and there's just no way this two couple's going to make it work. And how are they ever going to get together? And suddenly, you know, they have this weird moment in the park and they have to go back to the house and whatever. And they have, it's like, oh, they had sex. We know they're going to make it. That's what the narrative wants to tell us. It wants to tie these two together. And that's not the biblical understanding of the beauty or the gift of sex within marriage. And it's not how we understand how intimacy works. Now, is there intimacy in sex? Yes. is intimacy only found there? Absolutely not. And for many of you, this is not at all an issue. But for so many of us, this is an eroding factor in our lives that says, if I can find this, or if I don't have that, I don't get what I chiefly need. We can live without sex. It's not a need. Right? It's not a need. Our culture tells us that it should be listed among our needs. There's oxygen, there's food, there's water, there's sleep, and there's sex. Like somewhere in that list, it falls along the line. And we need it. We even be careful, married couples, how we use that phrase with one another. But it is not a need. No one dies from it. You do not need it. But we are not designed to live without intimacy. God has created us for intimacy. And so if it's not found exclusively through sex, then where are we to find it? Well, in many ways that we're going to talk about this over the next couple weeks, in particular, today I want us to talk about friendship. We need to elevate friendship. The gospel and the Bible elevates friendship in a way that our culture has eroded and taken us away. And when we see it even in our own churches today. I love this quote from C.S. Lewis. He says in his book, The Four Loves, those who cannot conceive friendship as substantive love, but only as a disguise or elaboration of eros, betray the fact that they have never had a friend. That is so good. That is so good. And I think the chief reaction to this is to say, well, you say you don't have friends? I have lots of friends. Okay, well, hang on. I think part of this is that we use the wrong words, or we've watered down the standard of what friendship or friend is, and therefore we are allowed to check that box in so many ways. That's not really helpful. When you think about this, this idea of we confuse one for the two, I can think of a couple examples. I've really gotten into audiobooks of big, thick biographies of of historical figures, and so they're super long. They take me like months and months, and I just kind of slowly but surely work my way through them. And what I have found is, over and over again, as I've been listening to these biographies of particularly men in the 18th and 19th centuries, that there's almost always going to be a point where the author has to discuss the sexuality of that individual, whether it's Abraham Lincoln, or it's Alexander Hamilton, or it's Ulysses S. Grant. There's going to be some point where he's got to pause and he's got to say, okay, so here are the circumstances. Abraham Lincoln was a traveling lawyer, and he traveled extensively with his junior partners. And when they were on the road, they always shared a bed together. When Abraham Lincoln had this best friend, and they were really close. And I mean, their letters back and forth together are super caring and affectionate for one another. And actually, when that friend had to move away, Abraham Lincoln was so distraught that he broke off his engagement to marry Todd and tried to move with him to another part of the state to be with his best friend. Right? When Abraham Lincoln was president, he often would share a bed with his bodyguards. I mean, why would the president need to share a bed with his bodyguards? Clearly, there's something homoerotic going on in Abraham Lincoln. We don't know about this. We don't have clear evidence, but you know, their culture is suppressed. Every time we have to have these kind of conversations, I'm actually not going to make a statement on Abraham Lincoln's sexuality, although I'm pretty confident that that he was heterosexual, but it's not necessarily as important as this. Extensively comes from a vast misunderstanding of friendship in our day and age now, that attempting to understand friendship in the 18th and 19th centuries, even in our own country, which does not seem all that far away, is like traveling to another country and trying to understand their culture. There's biblical examples of this. And so in 2 Samuel 1:26, Jonathan dies, and David writes this beautiful little couplet about how important Jonathan was to him, and he has this line that says that Jonathan's love to him was better than the love of a woman. And so there's been incredible speculation. Was David gay? Was he bisexual? What was his sexual orientation? Again, I think this speaks less to David and Jonathan's sexuality and more to the difficulties of David's sexual unions and intimacy with his three wives. Again, sex does not equal intimacy. David is married threefold, and he's writing, that's hard. That's difficult. The love I shared with this brother in arms is deeper, is more satisfying than in ways than that I've experienced even with these three women. Again, we see speculation about Paul in the same way. A lot of this comes from this idea from Lewis's quote that if you cannot conceive that friendship is a substantive love, but it's only as a disguise or an elaboration of eros, you betray the fact that you've never had a true abiding friend. And we're going to work through several Proverbs today. In Proverbs 18:24, I think it's helpful here. Proverbs 18:24 reads, "A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." This is the ESV translation. If you're reading this in other translations, you might find that it says, "A man of many friends may come to ruin," which can be confusing. And I think the ESV helps us here by trying to make a distinction between this level of acquaintance, right? A man of many acquaintances may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer to a brother. And I think this speaks well into our culture, particularly into a social media culture where we have changed the word friend now from merely a noun to be a verb. We friend someone. I friended them. And what we mean by that is that we allowed them to have access to our contact list, to our social media profile. And so we've friended them. They are my friend. And again, as we've watered that down and spread that out, so now we have hundreds, maybe thousands of friends. Suddenly it's become a misnomer as to whether or not you actually have a friend. And the Bible tells us here that this sets us up for ruin, right? A man of many companions, of many acquaintances, peers, buddies, may come to ruin. I think the best biblical example of this might be the prodigal son. So who chooses to run off, and he finds many companions. His wealth provides him with an abundance of people who are more than happy to hang out with him. But like another proverb tells him, when the wealth runs away, so do the friends. And it leads to ruin. This does not set us up well. So instead, we need to be looking for that friend who sticks closer than a brother. Now, I love that these two relationships are tied together. The idea of a friend and a brother. They're linked, but they're distinct. And so we'll see some of that distinction here in just a minute. But the connection here is the depth, the intimacy of this kind of friendship. That it's related to a brother. It even exceeds a brother, a close relative. Those who are, by God's design, in our lives to be that safety net, to be the ones who have experienced so much of life with us. So the first thing I want us to understand about this level of friendship is that it is non-transactional. this level of friendship is not built off of what I have to give you and what you have to give me. When we live in a transactional relationship, all we're looking for is from a consumer mindset of can you give me that little, maybe it's a little thing, maybe it's intimacy, maybe it's status, maybe it's access, maybe it is a service, a good, right? So we are not all friends with Bear just because he can get us coffee, right? Can you get us coffee? Yes. Is that why we're friends with him? No. This is not a transactional element. You are not friends with me. I can't get you anything. I'm sorry. I live on campus at the University of Arkansas, and I hang out with college students, and they're poor, and so am I. So if you want a front row seat to watch other people go to the football games, then I can help you with that. I can't get you tickets. Our friendships are not cannot be merely transactional. They must be about what sticks closer than a brother, what draws us in and keeps us there. And so that's what Proverbs 17:17 helps us understand, is that a friend loves at all times, at all times. This is the highs and the lows. This is not just when the money is there and the parties are good, like the prodigal son, but it is at all times. And a brother is born for adversity. So again, we see this linking of the level of depth and commitment of friend with family. They're tied together, but they're also made to be distinct. So Proverbs 17:7 says that a friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. So the idea here is that siblings or immediate family are a gift from God as a safety net in our life. So when adversity hits, it doesn't matter how far away my brother is. He's on the other side of the planet. He can call me. And in adversity, I will be there for him in that. That's the nature of family. It's a defining mark of family. We don't have to have spent a whole lot of time otherwise, right? But there is an obligation that I feel within me to be there for him in that. A friend loves at all times. And this is so we said friendship is first non-transactional. Secondly, it is voluntary. It's voluntary. That's one of the beauties of it, is that C.S. Lewis, again, in The Four Loves, talks about that it's one of the, like, least necessary of relationships. Like we don't need it to survive, and yet that's the beauty of friendship, of the voluntary nature of choosing to love and be open and to care alongside one another to this level at all times. So at all times is, of course, at the highest of highs. Now remember, the brother is there for the lowest of lows. He's there to make sure that there's a safety net underneath for the lowest of lows. But the friend loves for the full spectrum of your life, which means that they get to be there for the highest of highs, the beauty of that, and they get to be there for the lowest of lows. And so as we're talking about elevating this, we need to be thinking about this from a couple levels and a couple questions we're going to ask as we go through this is, are you this kind of friend for others? And do you have this kind of friend for yourself? Those are both good questions to ask. So are you, going back to non-transactional, are you a non-transactional friend? And for whom are you that non-transactional friend? You expect nothing out of them, and in return, you give them this kind of access. You are there for them at all times. Who's on that list for you that's not a blood relative, who's not someone in a marriage covenant with you? And then who are you offering that kind of friendship to? And then who is that kind of friend for you? Who have you sought out and have that kind of friend? And who have you then cherished and take leveraged, taken advantage of the fact that they have offered you that level of friendship? Do you treat them? They've given you that kind of access. They've given you that kind of care. They're with you at all times. Do we still treat them like a companion? Someone who just has a Facebook update on what's going on in our lives. They know all sorts of details about the pictures and the quotes and the meals that we're eating, but they don't have that intimate knowledge of who we are. So who are those people? And then secondly, come back to the voluntary. Have you volunteered for this? Have you signed up for this? And then to what degree have you done that? Now, when we talk about, again, we compare this idea of friend and brother, it is like and yet unlike family. So brother here has that element that they're my brothers, and they didn't volunteer for that. I have two younger brothers, and they didn't sign up to be my younger brothers. They just are along for the ride. And yet they choose in that. They still volunteer within that to uphold their obligations to love and to care and to serve me in ways that I do not deserve and by their gifts of God to me. I spent a lot of time yesterday on the phone with one of them talking through all of this and what a gift that was. And yet friendship is voluntary. Now, marriage might feel similar. Like, well, marriage is voluntary, but marriage is also different than the kind of friendship that we're talking about here. And this is often a mistake that many in our culture make, whether we are married or not, is to assume that marriage is just friendship to the nth degree. And while there are lots of similarities, there are also distinct differences between marriage and friendship. They are both voluntary, but one is covenantal and therefore exclusive, and the other is not. So my friendships deepen and broaden the more I am inclusive with this level of friendship. The more I add deeper friends into my life, the more each of those friendships blossoms and grows. So again, leaning on C.S. Lewis, he says that myself and my friends are so complex of creatures that one friend cannot bring out all the best in them. So they need multiple friends from multiple sides to bring out all the best in them. And then me, from my vantage point, get to see how that other friend brings out the best in my friend. And I get to see the best in them, something that I could not bring out of them, but I get to see it because of their other friendships. Because of the inclusivity of friendships, it grows and it deepens and the intimacy expands. That does not work in marriage. It's the opposite of what works in marriage. And so C.S. Lewis says that friendship is the least jealous of loves. It loves to see friendships grow. Now, I remember growing up, I remember having this distinct moment when I was a senior, when I had this like eye-opening thought where I thought, Brian Weatherford is my best friend. How did I not know that? And that might seem weird to you, but in my head, somehow, I had like elevated the idea of the best friend kind of to like a marriage-level commitment, right? If they're the best friend, there can be only one. Right? There are friends, and there are better friends, and there are best friends, and the best, well, there's only one of those, right? So I very much guarded the idea of who gets to have that, like, coveted title in my life. Who gets to be my best friend? And then this distinct moment, I'm like, Brian, how did this, it snuck up on me, you know? We hadn't really known each other until our junior year, and then we started hanging out, and then suddenly my senior year, Brian Weatherford is my best friend. And he was a great friend. Brian was a great friend and truly earned the title of best friend. But it was a misunderstanding in my heart that didn't understand that the idea that the more best friends that I have, the better. The more I expand that layer of friendship in my life, the better it is for me and the better it is for them. And so by God's grace in college, that shifted for me. And I had a group of mighty men that were my best friends. And they, to this day, they're those kind of friends that that we may not have seen or talked to each other in weeks, months, or years. And you walk back into the room and you're right back at it. Not just that you're nostalgic and you're swapping stories from back in the day. And then, of course, that happens because that's one of the building foundations of our friendship. But more than that, we are right back enjoying the intimacy of our friendship now and going forward. Right? That's the beauty of those of that kind of friendship. We want to look for those and cherish those and establish them, foster them within our church here. Now, so friendship at this level is non-transactional. It is voluntary. And then it is not superficial. It is intimate. Proverbs 27:9 says, "Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel." His earnest counsel. This relates to how the psalmist uses the term friendship in Psalm 25, verse 14. The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes them, and he makes known to them his covenant. The term there used for friendship can also be translated secret counsel. I included the footnote that you would find in your ESV, Bible. The idea of friendship is so tied to this idea of secret counsel, of earnest counsel. As I think about that in my own life, so in Friendiversaries, Stephen Martin and I are coming up on our 16th Friendiversary. So Stephen and Tamara moved back to Fayetteville at the end of July or beginning of August in 2003. I know that because I moved here to go to school in August of 2003. And so Stephen beat me by a couple weeks. We met before classes even started, the first week of my freshman year. Now, we didn't strike up a deep and abiding friendship at that point. But within the next year, I was in a small group that he was leading. And that relationship started to build. His investment in my life started to build. And by my junior and senior year, we were meeting every week, regularly. And so since then, we've continued to meet on a pretty regular rhythm. Not only just as friends that hang out in each other's homes, but just consistent time together. So I was trying to calculate. I think he and I have had breakfast together something like 300 times in the last couple of years. There were years where you could just regularly find us in a specific booth in a specific restaurant eating specific things for breakfast. Both of us, if we were go to the farmer's table with you on Wednesday morning, I could order for him and he could order for me. It's been a long time coming. And some of the like most significant moments of my life, I can chart where those conversations happened with Stephen. I can tell you the booth that we were in the rolling pin, when I had been thinking about it for weeks and I've been trying to figure out how I was going to tell Stephen. So we sat down and he's asking what's up and we're chit-chatting, and then I was like, I think I'm going to ask Caroline to marry me. And I laid out my case and I told him all the reasons why, and he goes, "Okay, sounds good." And I said, "That's it?" He goes, "You want me to talk you out of it? Like, that sounds like a great idea. Of course you guys should get married." And it was that the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. I needed him in that moment to say, "Yeah, that's a great idea. I love that." Stephen and I were eating breakfast together. I had brought Charlotte. She was, I can tell you exactly how old she was, because while we were sitting there, Caroline called to tell me that the doctor said, we're having a baby today, and we had Elliot, number two, that day. Stephen and I were at breakfast when that happened. There have been all sorts of conversations, hard conversations, where I have needed his earnest counsel and the sweetness of that. Now, do I remember every conversation Stephen and I have ever had? Absolutely not. Do I even remember most of the conversations that we have had? No. Do I know that he has been invested in my life now for 16 years? Absolutely. Is that the biggest difference he's made in my life? Absolutely. So if you were to go next door or listen in on the podcast on the discipling conversation, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about discipling. That's been a discipling relationship. Consistently, voluntarily investing in the spiritual good of my life over a long period of time in the same direction. But this is a deep and abiding friendship that involves the kind of jokes that I can make with him that no one else knows, the kind of secrets he knows about me that no one else knows. He knows about my sins. He knows about my temptations. He knows how to read me when I'm up. He knows how to read me when I'm down. He knows what I delight in. He knows my goals. He knows my hurts. Right? He knows those things. And as you're listening to that list, many of you start to think, wait, isn't that a list of things only Caroline should know? No. That is not a list of things only Caroline should know about me. Caroline does know my sins and my temptations. She does know my delights and my goals. She can read me when I'm up and she can read me when I'm down. She can tell, but that comes through intimacy. But Stephen Martin can do that for me too. And my brother Austin can do that for me too. And Jacob is learning how to do that for me. And there are so many other friends. Michael Gaddy can do that for me. David Haley can do that for me. I need those people in my life who can do that. That is the level of the level of friendship that we need, that the Bible has commanded us to have and created for, that God has created for us to have. And what's amazing about this is that we have this with Christ. This is the kind of language he uses for us. In John 15:15, he says, no longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. That's a transactional relationship. Employee to boss is a transactional relationship. There may be some camaraderie, there may be joking, you may enjoy their company, but it's a transactional relationship. The servant does not know what his master is doing. But, anytime the gospel uses the word but, it's almost always going to be significant. But I have called you friends. I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from the Father, I have made known to you. So how do we know that he has called us friends? For all that I have heard from the Father, I have made known to you. There is a level of intimacy that he has bestowed to us that has given us this access and given us this status as friend. And so, again, going back to who are we giving that kind of access away? Are we opening up our lives to others? And are we asking the kind of questions of others to get them to open up to us? Because not only can we recognize that he has opened up to us and that lets us know that we're friends, but he has opened up all that I have heard from the Father I have made known to you. He's held nothing back. That's pretty amazing. Like, the triune community in their eternal communion with one another have chosen that for those of us he has called friends, for those of us he has bestowed grace on, those he has brought in, he has shared all that I have heard from the Father with us. We have everything we need for life and godliness. We have access to the fullness of the Trinity in this beautiful relationship. He has made them known to us. He has intentionally shared them with us. He has not required us to go out and discover them. He has not required us to chisel it out of him, to interrogate him, to pull every little, to have this giant board with all of these strings tying all the pieces together to try to figure out the grand mystery. No, he has made it known to us. He has voluntarily made it known to us. This is the beauty of the relationship we have with Christ. When we talk about that there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother, it's Christ. He's the one who laid down his life for us, who opened his life up for us. And so we're to follow that model in how we become that friend who sticks closer than a brother to others, how we are a friend at all times. And we offer the earnest counsel that God gives to us. And so here are some final questions and final thoughts. One, first you need to voluntarily choose to open up. Choose to open up to others. For many of us, in particularly, for many those who have been hurt, or maybe those who have some sort of cultural expectation placed upon them, for many men, for many introverts, the idea of opening up is dangerous. Sam Elberry says, in our world, being deeply known and deeply loved often feel like alternatives. Because whenever we are deeply known and we have that intimacy, it also puts us in danger of being wounded in those same places. And so then we choose those to be alternatives. I can either be deeply known, or I can choose to be deeply loved, but in ways that are not related to being deeply known, which, if we're honest, is not actually being deeply loved. And so we choose hookup culture. We choose microwaved experiences of intimacy, and we tell ourselves, I am deeply loved, and I can have access to that deep love without being deeply known. And we have to retie those two together, and then we have to create those spaces, particularly for us within the body of Christ. We have to create these spaces where these are not seen as alternatives, where these are seen as worthwhile risks to be deeply known, to then also be deeply loved. And so we have to choose to open up. We also have to choose to ask good questions of each other. Now, we said that the beauty of the relationship with Christ is that we don't have to interrogate him, that he's opened it up. Yeah, it's true. And he's also perfect and sinless. And the other relationships we have are not going to be that case. And so we have to choose to ask good questions of one another. Remember, the thing that we have most in common is Jesus. And so it's always right for us to talk about Jesus with each other, to talk about the Bible with each other. Sometimes we run into conversational cul-de-sacs where we don't know how to have a conversation with each other. Alberry says singleness is often a cultural conversation cul-de-sac. You know, if for a lot of people, if you say, hey, are you married? If the answer is yes, we've got a whole list of other questions that we can ask and we can keep the conversation going. For many, if you say, well, are you married? And the answer is no, that person goes, we've arrived in a cul-de-sac and I have no idea how to extend this conversation, which is tragic, and it speaks a lot to the lack of relationship within, particularly even within our body. But what we always have in common is the gospel. And we never end up in conversational cul-de-sacs because we don't also like baseball and we don't also have the same job and we didn't also come from the same hometown and we don't also have the same life experiences. We have Jesus. And so we can always ask good questions and hear others open up. And then we have to choose to listen. Choose to listen well, which means that we don't speak and it takes time and we're not doing it transactionally. We're not thinking, if I listen long enough, I will get this out of this relationship. I will earn these points. We listen for the sake of listening. We listen for the sake of others. In particular, as we elevate friendship, what this does is it builds and it supports well those who have the status of single in our body, and it leverages them to utilize this gift of deep but also broad friendships that are not available to other members of our body who have a different marital status. Sex provides intimacy on a level that a single person does not have with that individual. There's a depth difference with a single individual. But singleness provides a breadth of intimacy that is often difficult for married people to compete with. The number of friends you're able to have extends beyond what that same person might be able to have if they're married. We want to leverage those things well. We need to do that well. Last story, and then I'll close. We'll take some time to answer questions and spend time with one another. Yesterday, I had a long, hard conversation with a former student who's not doing well and not walking with the Lord. And in the end of the day, a big part of our conversation was that he doesn't see the kind of conversations and the kind of care and community within Christianity that he thinks is supposed to exist. And so he's rejecting the Savior because he can't understand. He can't think that if the Bible tells me this kind of transformation should happen in their lives and I don't see it, then it must not be true. He must not really be able to do all the things that he says that he can do. When we have this kind of compelling community, to borrow that phrase, when we have these kinds of friendships and intimacies within the body, what it shows is that the gospel does have that power. It does have that power to transform how we relate to one another. And if it has that power, it also has the power to save. And at the end of the day, this is a gospel issue for us. How do we practically build those relationships, particularly as Paul talked about, male to male and his circumstances in life and his age and those kind of things? Yeah, I totally agree. I think that after a certain point in our culture, we run out of friend factories. So high school, college, sometimes right after college, they can be friend factory spaces where everybody is looking for friends. Everybody has all their Lego block pieces open and they're looking to attach. And then as we age, our culture tends to fill up those Lego blocks and we tend to lose all of our friend factories. So you go to work at a new place, you're the only one looking for new friends. You move to a new place, you're the only one looking for new friends. And those people are glad to be your friend, but they're not looking for it in the same way you are. And that changes things. When Brad and Aaron moved here, they talked about one of the chief distinctions between living in D.C. and living here in Fayetteville was in D.C., everyone was always moving. And so because of that, you were always bringing in new friends and sending out friends. And that created a culture where you knew you needed friends because you might lose somebody soon, and you had very recently experienced that I don't have friends, I need friends experience. I don't think we're good at that. UBC, I don't think we're good at that. I think even as Caroline and I thought back to, we invited the first year that the Wheelers were here, we invited them over to our house once. We were super excited. We had the pastor over and his family over for dinner, and we checked that box. And we lived off of that for like months. Like, man, we had the pastor over. That was not what the Wheelers needed. They didn't need us to invite them over once, right? They needed our friends. Paul, on your end, I think leveraging the idea of breadth, and that will build to depth versus trying to find it with depth with an individual or a couple and building that deep quickly, I think you're going to have to leverage the fact that you have time to spend time with lots of different people. And so you may have to have 7 or 8 friends that you're spending time with each week, that you're building little bit by little bit, but it's not gonna be a quick process. And I hate that. And then UBC, let's fix that. And I think one of the ways we fix that is we open up more of our normal lives together. And next week we're gonna talk about the distinction between hospitality and entertaining when it comes to building these kind of friends relationships. And just in particular, the distinction is that entertaining is the idea that you put on a show for others when they're in your home. Hospitality is that they're in your home and they see your home as it is. And we need to be more hospitable, 1 Peter 4, towards one another, which means we need to have more people in our lives just in the normal day-to-day parts of life. And knowing that over the long period of time will build depth and breadth, not because we've pulled off some great event and it immediately got us to that level. So, thank you. That was a great question, Paul.